Well, let's, boy, my voice. If we might take a quick 5 or 10 minute break, if you need to stretch, I hope that you'll come back. What's going to happen after the break, and then during the break, some of the ladies are going to have some more handouts for you. Then after the break, Greg Robertson wants to come and share just for a few moments, and then we are going to have an opportunity. Dr. Cotrera is going to be here. I'm going to be here. Greg's going to be here for any questions that you might have. And this may sound like this may sound silly or not. I'm going to ask Greg to open this casket during the break. Some of you are probably here, and you have probably never seen a casket up close. And I want you to be able to do that. I mean, that's what this is about. A casket is a box. They come in many shapes and sizes. Greg could talk a lot about that. They range in price and quality and function. Then you have a vault in the ground that casket goes into normally. But some of you have just never physically been around the tools of the funeral, and you need to do that. You need to see these things. And so I'm going to ask him to do that during the break. So let's stand up, and according to these clocks, if we could start just a couple minutes before the hour, we'll get going. I'm so glad you stayed here. I hope that today has proven to be both practically very helpful, but also challenging to you, just to, if nothing else, to help you begin to realize what some of the issues are. Sometimes it's good to even know what the questions are to ask. And so what we want to do is we're going to spend just a few moments. Greg Robertson is going to come and share with you just for a few moments from the perspective of a funeral home director. Again, I want to express my deep appreciation to Greg for coming. Greg Robertson has been serving in this ministry for over 20 years. He's the manager at the Arch L. Hetty Funeral Home on Frankfort Avenue here in town, and he's active in his local church. He's a deacon in his local church. We're so glad that he's here, and he's been such a help to us. And during the Q&A time, he's going to share for 10 or 15 minutes or so, and we're just going to open it up. And for those of you who need to leave at that point, that'll be fine. For those who want to stay, we can stick around for a few moments. Let me just call your attention to a couple of handouts. And if you did not get 87 things that must be done on the most difficult day of your life sheet, raise your hand and Munji will make sure you get one of those. I think she has everybody. And then she will have those second sheets to Dr. Drake's presentation at the registration table, and also the MP3 information at the registration table. So at the end, I won't have any need to say that again. We can just close at the end of our Q&A time, all right? Well, Greg, come and share with us. There's also a handout in your packet from Greg about clergy preference forms and information, and there are the videos that Greg has brought, which we're so thankful for this, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to keep a stock of these in our offices. If you'll see Laura in the SME office, you can check a set of these out and view those, and that way we can keep these for a long time and impact as many students as possible. So Laura will coordinate that, and we'll have a supply as well. So thank you so much. Greg, come. Share with us for a few minutes.
I appreciate this invitation to try to offer, a few words of advice. Last week, whenever I was called and asked if I would do this, in the past, there's been times when Southern Seminary and the faculty have actually come to our funeral home, and that might happen again. And I would welcome any of you all who would want to come on your own to meet me or stop by the funeral home and get a tour and all. I think it's extremely important, as it was mentioned early on in this conference, the relationship that we build, we as funeral directors, with the local clergies of the communities. We just recently had a new Methodist minister move into the Crescent Hill area, and word travels fast because of my relationship with the clergies. So I was prepared for him and actually sent him a little handwritten note and wanted to have lunch with him, because I think it's very important to learn these pastors, where they're from, them learn us, learn our Christian faith and values. I was 11 when I accepted Christ, and I knew I wanted to be a minister, but I knew I didn't feel comfortable getting up behind a pulpit. But I felt God had a ministry in mind, and my grandparents were in the funeral business, a little town in central Kentucky, Perryville. They didn't want me to go into this business because it was long hours, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We spent many a Christmas with families in our living room dealing with death. It was hard for me as a child to understand that. And then even as an adult, receiving a call from a family on Christmas Eve and then that Christmas morning consulting with that family, and it was a minister's wife who had died. And as I was trying to schedule a time for us to meet, I said to Reverend Binkley, I said, you know it's Christmas. And he says, but it's not to us. So I had to really rethink myself and where they were sitting. So I met with him that Christmas afternoon. Wasn't even planning on mentioning that, but again, that's just something in our lives. We as ministers on holidays might have to break from our schedules with our own families. But this is a dedication that we make to God and to our faith. This morning, about 4:30, when I was arising, I'm a morning person, I was thinking then, what was I going to say to you all? So I really thought, just a couple of minutes, I thought, well, I'm going to look up the definition of a funeral director in Webster's and see what it really says. One whose profession is the management of funerals and who is usually an embalmer. Well, you're an embalmer if you go to embalming school. In Kentucky, you don't have to go to school. You can actually learn our trade or profession by working under a licensed funeral director for 3 years. Sitting before a state board, if you pass the exam, you're a licensed funeral director. In some other states, you don't even have to do that. But again, I believe the best funeral directors come from experience and knowledge and working with directors in homes. And as I mentioned to some of the staff in our break, the word that stands out in my life is compassion. We have to be compassionate to those families. And we don't know, and we can't judge what backgrounds those families and those issues relating to the death are. But we have to be there to minister, regardless of their financial affairs. And that's the part of my business that I dread the worst, is having to talk about expenses. 2 weeks ago, we had a young lady, 39, who had battled cancer. I had buried her mother and father in the last 5 years. Knew she had lost her leg to cancer, but then got the call that she had died. And she left a 9-year-old and a little 4-year-old girl. And her husband hadn't selected any property, hadn't even thought about it. So our job began with that initial call. And as I say in my notes, after I receive a call from the family, my very next thoughts are, is there a church or a minister to call? Because they need to be involved with me right now and with that family if they haven't already been notified. So it's very important that this relationship begins from the minute one that I receive a call, and then my second call is to the pastor or to a minister. And so consequently, in communicating with that pastor, that church, and I'm very comfortable in the minister coming to the funeral home, actually during the initial arrangement, and sitting with us together with the family to figure out what type of service that family wants, and when they want it, and where they want it. I'm very open to church funerals. Again, it's building that relationship with that pastor and that church, and what is the most comfortable. The only time that we don't go to church, I would say, is some families are uncomfortable in coming back into that church that next Sunday, and all they see is their loved one down front. Now, I've heard that time after time after time. But except in those situations, I feel if the family have been involved in their church and active, then the services should be at church. But again, that's up to the family. We've commented on calling back a former pastor. And again, it's communicating. And as I said earlier, it used to be we had a church here where Brother Bob, who had been there 25 years, knew most of them, and they knew Brother Bob. But Brother Bob says, "Greg, I am no longer their pastor. I am willing to help minister to them, but I want the senior pastor involved." So it was just building a good relationship from that moment. And so that's all I'll say about that. You've got a sheet there that I printed. I found it this morning. I wasn't for certain if I could find it. 87 items that can actually happen for during a death. Down under E, notifying as soon as possible. Ministers listed as number 73. But, of course, it all depends in the layout as to these concerns. But as I said to you, once I receive a death call from a nursing home, hospital, chaplain, sometimes clergies, 50% is health care, 50% is normally from a family member. And then my second call is to that pastor or minister. I probably have 30 to 40% funerals a year where there is no pastor involved. They're not members of a church. They want us to secure a minister. I think it can be very rewarding to you all, if you're called upon by a funeral director, to try to help minister to this family. You might win a family. Some ministers are comfortable in doing that, and others aren't. But then there are those who are willing just to help us funeral directors in a hardship. Last year, I did 6 funerals myself. 6. I was surprised that I would have families who, I said, "Well, I'll get you a pastor," but I said, "I'm trying to be your funeral director," but they sort of knew me, and so I did this, but I have very much enjoyed this conference because I have picked up items that I feel that can help me, but I don't really want your all's job. I have enough to wear, but again, I was honored to be asked. I too have dealt with those issues of girlfriends and wives and relationships that were not known, and it is very touchy ground. But by all means, if I know about it, I'm going to let the pastor know about it too. We're going to sort of try to tread these waters together because I can't swim, and so maybe they can save me. We brought a casket. This casket is predominantly used for cremations. I actually buried one of these a few weeks ago. We had a family who wanted a wood, but these have actually been made to be used for a traditional service, then with a cremation to follow. So after I get the call, I call the minister. We set the time for the arrangements. If the minister wants to come in, great. If not, they'll just wait for our phone call. Then we'll schedule the visitation and the services. We'll communicate back with the pastor. Most of them want to be there when the family walks in for that first viewing. Now, at my location, we have families who quite a bit say, mother, dad, they have had a hard death. It's been a terminal illness, and we want a closed casket. And I said, you have that right, but we will want someone in the family to view your loved one. And hopefully during this private time, you can do that. And when they arrive and they see the calm expression, the expression of peace on their loved one's face, 9 times out of 10, they change their mind and they say, well, can we change our mind? So I too am not for a long, lengthy visitation, but we have geographic areas here in Louisville where they like 9 to 9, 12 hours. I've had 4 days of viewing on the same lady. She was in the room with my grandmother in a nursing home. And I watched that family come every day and feed Miss Greenwell her meals. She passed away on Labor Day, and when I met with the, it was the weekend before Labor Day. So I met with the family before I was going out of town, and Marge said, well, it Monday's Labor Day, we'll just have Mother's funeral on Tuesday. So I assumed visiting would be probably Monday, that Mother's Memorial Day. And she said, well, no, we're going to start it tomorrow, which is Friday. So we'll have Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, and the funeral on Tuesday. So needless to say, I got back in time for the visitation before it was over. So again, some families are very clear on what they want, and it might not be the most practical. But again, we're there to try to deal with those issues. I mentioned the financial end. Some families think that we're a bank, that they can just do a service on a loan way. We will try our best to work with families financially. We've never turned a family away who could not afford to pay for a funeral. I would never, ever do that. And regardless of what some families want, I give the same service to every family, which is dignified. One word on my business card is dignity. The words dignity and compassion is truly what I stand for. And the golden rule, which I tell all of our staff when a family entrusts their loved one into our procession, to treat them with respect and to do unto others as we want them to do unto us. A comment was made about honorariums. It's mentioned on your clergy preference form. It's a document that when we meet a new pastor, we would like for them to fill it out. If they want to keep a copy, so be it. But it helps us as to when we receive a call, then we'll sort of have an idea of what their do's and don'ts are. And there is an area on there which talks about gratuities, honorariums. The way I word it to a family is, when we get to that part of the arrangement. Now, let me back up and say, when a clergy comes in with the family to make arrangements, most of them have excused themselves when it comes down to casket selections and all. But for those who stay, that's fine too. Sometimes I won't talk about honorariums and things, though, in their presence. But I tell families, I said, I don't know of a clergy one that expects any type of a monetary honorarium. But it's just a token of appreciation if you all want to do this. And if you want us to do it, then we'll just cut a check and we'll put it with their clergy record form. For those who want to write a personal thank you note to you and put it in a note, so be it. But I mentioned there are a couple of religious denominations, because of their church expenses, they require a certain amount, and it covers musicians and just overall building expenses. So those folks are used to it, and we're used to it. But again, that's really never been that type of a concern. I've given large amounts because of people traveling. And, of course, I try to think ahead on some of that, because if you're traveling from out of state, then needless to say, I feel that families need to try to make compensations for that. It's been mentioned before about the graveside services, burials, interments. Here in Louisville, I wasn't used to chapels and cemeteries. I was always used to going to the grave, and I still am. I don't care what the weather is. I believe in carrying our loved one to the final resting spot, and especially if it's an earth burial, because the way I have always expressed or thought of when I'm talking to a family and they're looking at a casket, and I am fonder of woods than metals, but I'll say, well, we're a seed, and the tree was a seed, and it came out of Mother Earth, and consequently we're a seed, and we're just being planted back into Mother Earth. But sometimes, because of of personal issues and weather, inclement weather and all, it's easier to use a chapel. But again, that's up to the family. We try to make sure that we offer the suggestions and go from there. As to cremations, we've had families who have actually wanted to go to the crematory and watch their loved one be placed in the retort, which is the cremation oven, and stay there until they're brought out. I have never witnessed a burial at sea except by a video. And I would express that we, as funeral directors, try to follow up with families a few days after the service, because it is part of my responsibility, I feel, to follow up with any insurance, any type of death benefits, whether it's Social Security, veterans, government, any type of insurance, anything that the family wants to entrust into us, we are willing to help them, or at least give them some tools, numbers, etc. And then if they want to use an attorney, whatever, to help them deal in settling the estate. And then following up with aftercare planners or any type of videos that I've brought to you all today. I've brought three or four, and I'm sorry I only got three of them here. Someone you love is dying, how do you cope? A child's view of grief, and the other one is working through your grief. So some of these tools could maybe be very helpful for yourself or for those that you minister to. And I thank you again on behalf of the funeral home and for Southern Seminary for inviting me.
Thank you. If we could do this for a couple of reasons, if you have a question that you'd like to ask, I am going to ask you to step to one of the two floor mics for a couple of reasons. One is, if nothing else, for the recording purpose so that the question can be recorded. I know some of you have class and you're going to be coming in and out for the next few moments. But if you have a pressing question that you'd like to ask, now is your time to please do so. So if you'll step to one of the microphones, if there's anything that you would like to ask that has not been covered. And if not, we'll draw to a conclusion. Yes, good.
I have actually a couple questions. One thing that I recently have been asked to do is in the dying husband of a lady that is a member of my church, and I went with their two sons. And one of the reasons they wanted me to go was for prayer. But then when I got there, I also found out that they wanted me there because he had decided in these last moments, he had been told he had about 2 or 3 days to live. He wanted to change his will. And this was at about at midnight on a Saturday night. And so what is our role? What is the legality of that? Is that even legal? Is it something that we should be involved in? How do we handle that situation? So that's my first question.
Well, I'll let Greg start, and then I'll...
Well, you could be a witness.
Right. If the person is of sound mind, you can be a witness to what they say.
But that's about it.
Any will, any time, can be disputed
right.
by anybody. So that sort of thing, 2 days before death, if there's a major change, there's going to be there may well be some family friction.
Okay. One of the things, I grew up in an attorney's home, and one of the things my father's showed me, a handwritten will is a legal will, but it is easily contested.
Right.
And so any change that a person makes at that kind of moment, what my advice to the family would be I would be glad to witness that if that's something I can do for you, but I would always advise them to consult legal advice if it's something that they want to be binding and not disputed later. I would just give fair warning that certainly be glad to help you here, but I would probably be in touch with my family attorney to also discuss that with them just to make certain that this would be a binding and wouldn't be disputed later. But you're right. In fact, one of the notes I had here was legal paperwork. I was thankful that Dr. Magnuson touched on several things from the orders in the hospital to the living wills to some of the other legal paperwork. Because you will find yourself, you do need to become somewhat knowledgeable of what these terms are and what these documents are, because you will be asked just because you're there, even though you have no expertise necessarily.
I'll elaborate on the about cremation. There are a lot of families who are opposed to cremation, and loved ones will come in ahead of time and prearrange and actually prepay it. But again, in Kentucky, the next of kin has to give authorization, even if you've prearranged your own cremation. So if you have a wife or spouse, the spouse has to give written authorization. If there's no spouse, then it's children, all the children, whether there's one or 14, they all have to sign. If there's no children, then siblings. So that's the law in Kentucky, and it's about the same in any state concerning cremation. But I try to tell families, I said, you know, it's like making a will. Those are your loved one's final wishes. If this is what they chose, you should honor that. But again, I'm really putting my neck out by saying that to them. But again, I just feel that's a part of my responsibility for what that person wanted. But again, it's up to the next of kin.
And I think there's a valid point that Greg makes in the fact that here in Kentucky, there's a state law. Well, that's part of when you go to a ministry position where you are, you need to know what the laws are. Mm-hmm. Just as you find out what the law is for registering your license or whatever to perform weddings, you need to understand some of the legalities around death and to consult with an attorney. If you had an attorney in your church, it'd be a good person to talk to, or your funeral home directors, your hospital administrators, people like this who deal with these legal documents on a regular basis. Understand what the laws are, because you may find yourself in a position of counsel, and it would be helpful for you to know. But always remember that you're not an attorney and that you're not offering legal opinion. What you're doing is you're offering advice and counsel, and ultimately, I would refer them to legal counsel for anything that would be a binding legal document. But those are issues that are real issues, and you will deal with those on a regular basis. That's another reason why proactively, the more people can pre-plan and pre-arrange their funerals and have some of this documentation in a place where everyone knows where it is, that little sheet that I gave you, the information that Greg's given you, the more you can do that, keep it with a life insurance policy, put it in the safety deposit box, everybody knows where it is. It just makes the process so much easier from the pastoral care and grief standpoint. You know, I don't have to worry about trying to figure out what the hymns are. You know, she picked those out. I don't have to do that. My mother, I have my mother's folder. I mean, extensive notes. My mother planned her own funeral down to which verse of what hymns were going to be sung. It made it so easy for us. And I highly advise it. It's not something that people like to talk about all the time, but... anyway, any other questions? Good. Just.
I have two. One, are there any other special groups besides the Masons that have burial type rites? And secondly, what type of counseling aids have you recommended to people? Books? I know that maybe there's some support groups, but what types of aids that maybe would be generally available?
You want to hit the groups, and then you want to do counseling aids?
Well, right off the top of my head, I can't name a group.
Eastern Star.
But we have, Masonic groups. Well, yes, there's the Eastern Star. There's the International of Odd Fellows. There's the Shriners that come to my mind right now.
All components of the Masonic Lodge. I don't know of anybody outside the Masonic Lodge other than veterans.
Veterans.
That supports. Do anything special. Mm-hmm. Veteran support groups or auxiliaries.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I don't know.
Since 9/11, the government has really tried to upbeat their burial services for the veterans. Now, since we've gone back to war, we've sort of tilted back again as to getting enough service people to be able to provide a full detail, whether it's pallbearers, but we at least have two people representing that branch of service and one that plays the taps and presents the flag. I liked how he likes to have the flag presented during the committal service, and actually it is part of the committal service. It used to be when the pastor was done, then I would step up and present the flag and say, on behalf of a grateful nation, I present this flag for your husband's faithful duty to his service. But I like how we incorporate that part, because that veteran did give their time to our country, and then there's a closing prayer. But
and I've had to help fold the flag before. I mean, I've been in positions where there was not a detail, and it was a veteran. And so in a very unofficial way, sort of,
I mean, the funeral home director in an official way was handling this, and the funeral home director and I folded the flag together. And of course, obviously, that's something you want, you know, you have worked out in advance. What are some of the counseling aids? Do you have anything, Dr. Couture?
The one I use the most, particularly for miscarriage and stillbirth, is one called I'll Hold You in Heaven. And it's quite good. Most folks in grief, to give them a book isn't the best thing. I'd rather you became skilled at the grief process, and there are lots of ways we can help you with that, so that you know how to be the physical presence and speak the words. Giving a book sometimes then feels a little impersonal, at least for the first, the crisis time.
Sure, yeah, I was thinking later on, mm-hmm. as they're processing.
Let me make one other comment about this grief. This December, we've been doing this for several years now, we offer a candlelight service at several of our chapels where we try to invite all the families from that previous year to come together to remember their loved one. And it's a brief service. Normally there's a pastor, and then there are some family members who might read a poem together, and then there's a candle lighting. But at least we feel that it's important for that group to come together to remember their loved one, and then take that candle back home and burn it during the holiday.
Good.
I think it was Dr. Couture, I think you mentioned earlier that if we have family members who die, it's best if we don't officiate so that we can actually go through the grieving process. I have a seeming notion that some of my family might be asking me to take that spot in the future. And it's a little bit sticky considering that many of them are unconverted. But I'm kind of curious what your counsel or if you guys have any wisdom in terms of that.
Well, I would not discourage you from participating in the service.
Right.
In that particular instance, if you are the sole believer in the family and you are invited, then I would take that responsibility. I'm particularly speaking to the really close relationship. If it is your mother, your father, or your spouse, or your child. Now, if it's a cousin, and that may be something that you can do and do very well. But I actually wanted to free some of you from feeling the burden of you must do that, when what you may need to do is grieve and have a fellow pastor or brother be the lead out and you be part of the service. One of the things that often happens is people will want to share, and I always have them write that out, and then I'll stand with them at the pulpit, so if they cannot speak, I can help read what they said. And it takes some of the pressure off that moment, because they want to say these things, but they can't physically because of just the grief symptoms. So the things you can do to make the service move flow, and it may be you that has the difficulty, it's quite all right. Just have a plan as to how that will work. And sometimes having a brother that's a pastor as well, a brother in the faith that's a pastor, can make that process well and really minister nicely to you and the family.
Anyone else?
I'm trying to remember in philosophy class, or it might have been in ethics, but Dr. Drake raised a question about maybe counseling people who've lost a child and what to tell parents or family members. And then he also mentioned suicides, and I'm just what to counsel family members in those situations. I guess both saved and unsaved.
It's a pretty big topic. One of the key things with suicide victims is you must decide whether suicide is the unpardonable sin. And I've already decided that for a believer, it's not. And so to understand that and be able to comfort the family, for me, flows out of my theology. The trouble with infant and children death is people saying things like, God needed them, God wanted them, God took them for that, which leaves the surviving children in a panic that God might someday take them away. So you want to communicate truth, but with grace and love in a way that that person can understand it. And that's an entire semester that it takes some experience and some skill. We can remember the ones we've seen done badly. Hopefully there are some examples you've seen that have been done well.
I do think it's a great example too, though, of applied theology, in the sense that as seminary students, those of you who are seminary students, you come and you learn your systematic. Well, you need to understand your theology of death. You need to understand your theology of suicide. You need to understand these things, So that you need to understand those now. You need to have that in place so that when these moments come, you're prepared to give those answers. And so it is interesting how even though you may not preach a doctrinal sermon or a great theological treatise as a funeral message, you still have to have that theology as a foundation in order to know how to work through this situation. And so it's a great example of where you see the classical and the practical coming together.
Yes. This is a little different, but had a young fellow who was deaf, and he was up on the railroad tracks of a bridge. He never heard the train whistle, but then he started feeling the tracks, but there was nowhere for him to go. So the train killed him. His body was mangled. His mother came to see me, a dozen times in that next year, wanting to know if that was truly her son in the casket. Mm-hmm. So the reality of, has our loved one not only, are they saved, but did you really have my loved one? It was, I couldn't assure, but any more than what I could.
That is really such a good point from my perspective, because many times with a stillbirth, the question arises, should the parent see the child? Let me tell you as strongly as I can, if you want a healthy grieving process, there must be closure. They must, they as best you can, encourage them to see, to hold the child. We've got some skill. There's always something that's beautiful about a baby, even if there's been problems. And it will help down the road. When they refuse, we take pictures, get samples of hair, because we know 6-8 weeks down the road, there's going to be precisely what Greg was talking about, that was it really, did it happen? And this is a way that you can help the process. Tuck that in the back of your mind. Those are both examples of things where you will be the person that can make a huge difference.
Anyone else?
One last one.
In thinking about pastoral care down the road, a bereaved family, do you have any particular advice or experiences regarding how to help them through their first set of holidays, the first Christmas alone, Easter, birthday, whatever? Those seem to be particularly hard times.
You're exactly right, and that's a good understanding for all of you. The holidays without Grandpa for the first time are going to be tough. The Thanksgiving table without him sitting at it is going to be really hard. So you're understanding that. You can preload that with either a card or a call, just a bit of understanding. Say, I know this day may be tough for you, and then talk to them afterwards. But understand, some of this has to be gone through. You can't avoid it. Grief has to be experienced, but we can help make that experience better. And by knowing anniversary dates, their wedding date, those kind of things, you just get that in your computer file somehow and make the call or send a card. And the day will probably come where you send an email. I don't know. But usually it's just a personal connection. They know you remember. They know that you care. But that is an astute point, because those will be the first year, second year gets better and eventually improves. But those family kind of gatherings with someone missing are hard.
It's a ministry of presence, to where it expands beyond you. Hopefully your deacon ministry is involved in this. You have care groups, support groups within your church. You might even have a support group specifically designed for those who've suffered losses in life. You may have special events that you create for those widows or widowers who would be alone. You'd be double-checking to make sure they're not going to be absolutely alone at Thanksgiving or absolutely alone at Christmas, that family's coming and things like that. But it becomes a corporate opportunity for the church as well to continue that follow-up. Anyone else?
I'd like to ask a practical question about Masons and things like that. I don't really know what happens at that. I have been in a service where there were Masons. I didn't really know what was going on. And I think in that instance, the pastor really led the whole church away and left the Masons at the graveside with the body, and just seeing how you handle that and what you do. Do you stand there as an endorsement, or do you leave, or whatever?
Well, that you're going to have to make some personal decisions about about that yourself. Here's where I guess I have been, practically speaking. Normally for me, and Greg, chime in if you see this differently. Normally in my experience, this was always at the graveside. There might be a wreath signifying the lodge or something in the memorial service or something like that. But the participation in the service itself and the services in which I officiated, I'm trying to think if there was an exception to this, and there might be that I can't remember, but it was almost always at the graveside. And at that point, basically, I made sure I was basically done, really, and the lodge took over. I did not leave because I felt like that the bridges of ministry to the family and to minister to them would be more damaged by me showing some kind of protest or something at that point to what was happening. The Masonic ritual that they go through, I don't know who all has seen this or experienced this or not. I actually used to be, I guess I better not say anything. But anyway, in a former life, experienced it from another side. But the Masonic ritual that they go through is not necessarily offensive to me per se, as far as the actual words that are said in the ceremony. So I'm walking a tightrope here a little bit. So what I do physically, practically, is I'm done at that point. The lodge takes over. I'm just stepping to one side at that point. And then when they're done, I'm still going to come back and greet the family and love them and minister to them. The bottom line is this is a family decision to have this as part of their ceremony. And so I have to make a conscious choice of if in protest or what. I'm not sure that's my time to protest the lodge at the gravesite. I think that those are discussions that can be had at a time. And what I want to make sure, if they need to be had, in other words, depending upon what your view of the lodge is, if I feel the need to discuss that later, then that's something I would do separate from this grieving death experience. At that point, I'm there to minister and to help, and I want to build bridges. So that if I do want to have a discussion later on about the lodge, then that's something we could have if we need to, whether we needed to or not. So I have seen that happen. I have been at a service where the minister left at that point. I personally, for better or for worse, would not. I stay there. I want to minister. My main concern are those people, and that's this family, and ministering to them. And so in a similar way, I've been in services of unchurched people to where they certainly shared things and did things that, from a biblical standpoint, I don't necessarily agree with. And yet I'm not going to walk out or anything at that point. That's not my role. My role at that point is to minister and to help show them truth and to help show them compassion, help show them love. So that, because my burden for them is I want them to find the answer for hope and for peace, and for strength. And my presence is needed to communicate that. So it can be a little interesting if you haven't been through that and seen that. Do you have any comment or thought about that? About the lodge and about the Masons?
Well, as I said, most of them here in Louisville are done the evening before. I couldn't tell you the last time I saw one done at the grave. Now, down home, it's done at the grave. But most of the men today are working, and so consequently, it's easier for them to do it
totally
the night before.
Service.
It's totally separate. And I feel like yourself, you would do more harm if you walked away. Just you're there for the family, and you just have to break your thoughts and feelings of this lodge as they do their service.
And on a personal note, it's interesting because it might even be hypocritical. I don't feel the same way about weddings. You know, in a wedding ceremony, we're planning a worship service together, and because of the premarital care, because it's so proactively done. I don't do last-minute weddings, that kind of thing. So you're so proactively working toward that, you're shaping this whole event. And so in that event, content, I do have a lot more to say about content. But again, in a funeral, to some degree, I'm being invited to participate by the family. And I need to do what I've been invited to do. I don't necessarily have control over the whole experience. And there have been times that I have been frustrated when there has been a funeral held in the sanctuary of the church of which I'm the pastor, where things are shared from the pulpit about a life that really was not a godly life. I mean, I don't want to go into detail, but I mean, very obvious. I mean, people sharing eulogies and bragging about those things that we would just consider ungodly. And those are very frustrating moments. And you have to work through that, but you have to decide, what am I going to do? You know, I can either jump up, turn the power off, or get this guy on my pulpit, or I've got to endure this experience and then pick up the pieces later in ministry and make sure folks understand where I'm coming from or whatever. Pretty rare occasion, I think, when that happens. Very quickly, anybody else? Yep. It's a good question, though.
Suppose you're dealing with a family who lost a loved one and they don't have any type of life insurance, and the family barely has two nickels to rub together. What are the minimum requirements that Kentucky has for burying somebody? Do you need to go through a funeral home? And if you do, what are some prices in a funeral home?
That's a good question. Each county normally sets aside an allotment of funds for families who are destitute, and it's considered a county funeral. And normally there is a funeral home in the county that will provide some type of a service. Now, what Jefferson County offers is just a graveside service, and then they have there's a grave site. It's out in the southwestern end. It's around Dixie Highway. I think it's called Riverview Cemetery. But the county provides a space for their loved one to be buried. The funeral home gets $300. But as I said, we've never turned a family away. But if we got word, and it used to be, it wasn't uncommon for us to do 50 infants a month. And the word got out that at the local hospitals that Hetty's will bury all the babies free. Well, the expense was just getting to the point that we've had to set a minimum charge for burials of infants as well as adults. But the county, if the families can't come up with anything, I've never turned a family to the county. But again, I guess it would just depend upon personal issues or something, not to try to work with that family. But there are probably about 200 to 300 county burials a year. And the coroner's office is trying to come up with a way to even mark their graves with a marker. So Social Security used to pay on everybody. Social Security now only pays if you have a spouse. I'm not married. And if I died right this moment, my parents would not get the $255 that I work and pay into every month or every paycheck.
What would you say the average cost of a regular, quote-unquote, normal funeral is?
The nation average is around $5,600. I do cremations that start at $895, and they go up from there.
There really isn't an upper limit, and that's what's not, during the break we were talking about the fact, for example, just a casket, it really is so much of a personal choice, because there are bronze and copper caskets and you know, fine wood caskets of cherry and oak, and with every elaborate, I'm confident a family could spend every bit as much as they could ever imagine spending if
Absolutely.
They wanted to, you
Absolutely.
Know, just because yeah. of the high end of the product lines that they can obtain. So the upper limits are really, really quite high, probably.
I've talked families down. I mean, I have to be able to lay my head down at night and have a conscience. And I would rather, well, I've had families who feel that they just have to buy the nicest or the best they think, it's a show. And I tell them, I said, if besides the you all immediate family, hardly anybody could tell you what kind of casket they're in. I just don't. But there are communities where people try to outdo each other. I mean, I hear that from the local funeral directors when I'm at a convention. But again, it's not necessary. I don't. 30% of my business at my location is cremation. And again, we could discuss anything from direct cremation with no type of a service. But I prefer families to at least have a memorial service, whether they do it with me or at a church. I'm still willing to go and help them try to have some type of a closure. And it's very important that everybody look at the deceased. And now, a lot of our families on a cremation, they don't want to view. And I tell them someone has to view them if I don't know them, because I don't know everybody that I serve. That's the difference from a small community funeral director and a urban city like Louisville. I've worked Oklahoma, I've worked Germantown, Hikes Point, and Crescent Hill now 23 years. So I've served over 1,000 families, and I have a pretty good memory for faces, better than for names. But again, it's trying to get back to you though financially. I don't know of any of our funeral homes here in Louisville who can't work with families. But again, if they want to be extravagant, then they're going to have to find the means to take care of it.
We need to wrap this up. But huh?
What's the cheapest casket?
The cheapest casket.
$7.95. It's a pressed wood with a gray cloth covering.
Let me just read one verse and then we're going to go. And this is a verse that relates almost indirectly. You know, when we're talking about the messages, we're talking about whether we should share the gospel or not. I'm just reminded of 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect. Now, I think that that's a pretty good verse for me to keep in my heart as I'm working with families. I want them to know why I believe there's hope, and I want to communicate that message. But it needs to be done with a gentleness and respect at this moment in life, to where they are understanding that it's coming out of compassion and love. I want to thank everybody for coming. We appreciate you helping us with this first run. We're looking forward to the spring doing something similar with weddings. We're looking at having flowers and, you know, who knows what else for that. So it'll be a fun time, and we'll look forward to doing this again next time. Thank you all so much. God bless you. You're cute.